I want to remember this just the way it was. He pauses for quite a while. Well, it all started with a letter I got while I was out in Buell, Idaho. That was September or October. The letter was from Dick, and he said he was on to a cinch. The perfect score. I didn't answer him, but he wrote again, urging me to come back to Kansas and go partners with him. He never said what kind of score it was, just that it was a sure-fire cinch. Now, as it happened, I had another reason for wanting to be in Kansas around about that time. A personal matter I'd just as soon keep to myself. It's got nothing to do with this deal. Only that otherwise I wouldn't have gone back there. But I did. And Dick met me at the bus station in Kansas City. We drove out to the farm, his parents' place. But they didn't want me there. I'm very sensitive. I usually know what people are feeling. Like you. He means Dewey, but does not look at him. You hate handing me a butt. That's your business. I don't blame you. Any more than I blame Dick's mother. The fact is, she's a very sweet person. But she knew what I was. A friend from the walls. And she didn't want me in her house. Christ, I was glad to get out. Go to a hotel. Dick took me to a hotel in Olathe. We bought some beer and carried it up to the room. And that's when Dick outlined what he had in mind. He said after I'd left Lansing, he sailed with someone who'd once worked for a wealthy wheat grower out in western Kansas. Mr. Clutter. Dick drew me a diagram of the Clutter house. He knew where everything was. Doors, halls, bedrooms. He said one of the ground floor rooms was used as an office, and in the office, there was a safe. A wall safe. He said Mr. Clutter needed it because he always kept on hand large sums of cash. Never less than $10,000. The plan was to rob the safe, and if we were seen, well, whoever saw us would have to go. Dick must have said it a million times. No witnesses. Dewey says, how many of these witnesses did he think there might be? I mean, how many people did he expect to find in the Clutter house? That's what I wanted to know. But he wasn't sure. At least 4. Probably 6. And it was possible the family might have guests. He thought we ought to be ready to handle up to 12. Dewey groans, Dunce whistles, and Smith, smiling wanly, adds, me too. Seemed to me that was a little off. 12 people. But Dick said it was a cinch. He said, we're gonna go in there and splatter those walls with hair. The mood I was in, I let myself be carried along. But also, I'll be honest, I had faith in Dick. He struck me as being very practical, the masculine type, and I wanted the money as much as he did. I wanted to get it and go to Mexico. But I hoped we could do it without violence. Seemed to me we could if we wore masks. We argued about it. On the way out there, out to Holcomb, I wanted to stop and buy some black silk stockings to wear over our heads. But Dick felt that even with a stocking he could still be identified. Because of his bad eye. All the same, when we got to Emporia, Dunt says, hold on, Perry. You're jumping ahead. Go back to Olathe. What time did you leave there?
1. 1:30.
We left just after lunch and drove to Emporia, where we bought some rubber gloves and a roll of cord. The knife and shotgun, the shells. Dick had brought all that from home. But he didn't want to look for black stockings. It got to be quite an argument. Somewhere on the outskirts of Emporia, we passed a Catholic hospital, and I persuaded him to stop and go inside and try and buy some black stockings from the nuns. I knew nuns wear them. But he only made believe. came out and said they wouldn't sell him any. I was sure he hadn't even asked, and he confessed it. He said it was a pukey idea. The nuns would have thought he was crazy. So we didn't stop again till Great Bend. That's where we bought the tape. Had dinner there. A big dinner. It put me to sleep. When I woke up, we were just coming into Garden City. Seemed like a real dead dog town. We stopped for gas at a filling station. Dewey asks if he remembers which one. Believe it was a Phillips 66. What time was this? Around midnight. Dick said it was 7 miles more to Holcomb. All the rest of the way he kept talking to himself, saying this ought to be here and that ought to be there, according to the instructions he'd memorized. I hardly realized it when we went through Holcomb. It was such a little settlement. We crossed a railroad track. Suddenly Dick said, "This is it. This has to be it." It was the entrance to a private road, lined with trees. We slowed down and turned off the lights. Didn't need them. Account of the moon. There wasn't nothing else up there. Not a cloud. Nothing. Just that full moon. It was like broad day. And when we started up the road, Dick said, "Look at this spread. The barns. That house. Don't tell me this guy ain't loaded." But I didn't like the setup. The atmosphere. It was sort of too impressive. We parked in the shadows of a tree. While we were sitting there, a light came on. Not in the main house, but a house maybe 100 yards to the left. Dick said it was the hired man's house. He knew because of the diagram. But he said it was a damn sight nearer the clutter house than it was supposed to be. Then the light went off. "Mr. Dewey, the witness you mentioned. Is that who you meant? The hired man?" "No. He never heard a sound. But his wife was nursing a sick baby. He said they were up and down the whole night." "A sick baby. Well, I wondered." While we were still sitting there, it happened again. A light flashed on and off. And that really put bubbles in my blood. I told Dick to count me out. If he was determined to go ahead with it, he'd have to do it alone. He started the car. We were leaving, and I thought, "Bless Jesus. I've always trusted my intuitions. They've saved my life more than once." But halfway down the road, Dick stopped. He was sore as hell. I could see he was thinking, "Here I've set up this big score. Here we've come all this way, and now this punk wants to chicken out." He said, "Maybe you think I ain't got the guts to do it alone. But by God, I'll show you who's got guts." There was some liquor in the car. We each had a drink, and I told him, "Okay, Dick, I'm with you." So we turned back, parked where we had before. In the shadows of a tree, Dick put on gloves. I'd already put on mine. He carried the knife and a flashlight. I had the gun. The house looked tremendous in the moonlight. Looked empty. I remember hoping there was nobody home. Dewey says, "But you saw a dog?" "No. The family had an old gun-shy dog. We couldn't understand why he didn't bark, unless he'd seen a gun and bolted. Well, I didn't see anything or nobody. That's why I never believed it. About an eyewitness. Not eyewitness. Witness. Someone whose testimony associates you and Hickok with this case." "Oh. Him. And Dick always said he'd be too scared." "Ha!" Dunce, not to be diverted, reminds him, "Hickok had the knife. You had the gun. How did you get into the house?
The door was unlocked. A side door. It took us into Mr. Clutter's office. Then we waited in the dark, listening. But the only sound was the wind. There was quite a little wind outside. It made the trees move, and you could hear the leaves. The one window was curtained with Venetian blinds, but moonlight was coming through. I closed the blinds, and Dick turned on his flashlight. We saw the desk. The safe was supposed to be in the wall directly behind the desk, but we couldn't find it. It was a paneled wall, and there were books and framed maps, and I noticed on a shelf a terrific pair of binoculars. I decided I was going to take them with me when we left there.
Did you? Asks Dewey, for the binoculars had not been missed.
Smith nods. We sold them in Mexico.
Sorry. Go on.
Well, when we couldn't find the safe, Dick doused the flashlight and we moved in darkness out of the office and across a parlor, a living room. Dick whispered to me, couldn't I walk quieter? But he was just as bad. Every step we took made a racket. We came to a hall and a door, and Dick, remembering the diagram, said it was a bedroom. He shined the flashlight and opened the door. A man said, "Honey?" He'd been asleep, and he blinked and said, "Is that you, honey?" Dick asked him, "Are you Mr. Clutter?" He was wide awake now. He sat up and said, "Who is it? What do you want?" Dick told him, very polite, like we were a couple of door-to-door salesmen, "We want to talk to you, sir. In your office, please." And Mr. Clutter, barefoot, just wearing pajamas, he went with us to the office and we turned on the office lights. Up till then, he hadn't been able to see us very good. I think what he saw hit him hard. Dick says, "Now, sir, all we want you to do is show us where you keep that safe." But Mr. Clutter says, "What safe?" He says he don't have any safe. I knew right then it was true. He had that kind of face. You just knew whatever he told you was pretty much the truth. But Dick shouted at him, "Don't lie to me, you son of a bitch. I know goddamn well you got a safe." My feeling was, nobody had ever spoken to Mr. Clutter like that. But he looked Dick straight in the eye and told him, being very mild about it, said, well, he was sorry, but he just didn't have any safe. Dick tapped him on the chest with the knife, says, "Show us where that safe is, or you're going to be a good bit sorrier." But Mr. Clutter, oh, you could see he was scared, but his voice stayed mild and steady. He went on denying he had a safe. Sometime along in there, I fixed the telephone, the one in the office. I ripped out the wires, and I asked Mr. Clutter if there were any other telephones in the house. He said yes, there was one in the kitchen. So I took the flashlight and went to the kitchen. It was quite a distance from the office. When I found the telephone, I removed the receiver and cut the line with a pair of pliers. Then, heading back, I heard a noise, a creaking overhead. I stopped at the foot of the stairs leading to the second floor. It was dark, and I didn't dare use the flashlight. But I could tell there was someone there, at the top of the stairs, silhouetted against a window. A figure. Then it moved away. Dewey imagines it must have been Nancy. He'd often theorized, on the basis of the gold wristwatch found tucked in the toe of a shoe in her closet, that Nancy had awakened, heard persons in the house, thought they might be thieves, and prudently hidden the watch, her most valuable property. For all I knew, maybe it was somebody with a gun. But Dick wouldn't even listen to me. He was so busy playing tough boy, bossing Mr. Clutter around. Now he'd brought him back to the bedroom. He was counting the money in Mr. Clutter's billfold. There was about $30. He threw the billfold on the bed and told him, "You've got more money in this house than that. A rich man like you, living on a spread like this?" Mr. Clutter said that was all the cash he had, and explained he always did business by check. He offered to write us a check. Dick just blew up. "What kind of Mongolians do you think we are?" And I thought Dick was ready to smash him, so I said, "Dick, listen to me. There's somebody awake upstairs." Mr. Clutter told us the only people upstairs were his wife and his son and daughter. Dick wanted to know if the wife had any money, and Mr. Clutter said if she did, it would be very little. A few dollars. And he asked us, really kind of broke down, please not to bother her, because she was an invalid. She'd been very ill for a long time. But Dick insisted on going upstairs. He made Mr. Clutter lead the way. At the foot of the stairs, Mr. Clutter switched on lights that lighted the hall above, and as we were going up, he said, "I don't know why you boys want to do this. I've never done you any harm. I never saw you before." That's when Dick told him, "Shut up. When we want you to talk, we'll tell you." Wasn't anybody in the upstairs hall, and all the doors were shut. Mr. Clutter pointed out the rooms where the boy and girl were supposed to be sleeping, then opened his wife's door. He lighted a lamp beside the bed and told her, "It's all right, sweetheart. Don't be afraid. These men, they just want some money." She was a thin, frail sort of woman in a long white nightgown. The minute she opened her eyes, she started to cry. She says, talking to her husband, "Sweetheart, I don't have any money." He was holding her hand, patting it. He said, "Now don't cry, honey. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's just I gave these men all the money I had, but they want some more. They believe we have a safe somewhere in the house. I told them we don't." Dick raised his hand, like he was going to crack him across the mouth. Says, "Didn't I tell you to shut up?" Mrs. Clutter said, "But my husband's telling you the God's truth. There isn't any safe." And Dick answers back, "I know goddamn well you got a safe, and I'll find it before I leave here. Needn't worry that I won't." Then he asked her where she kept her purse. The purse was in a bureau drawer. Dick turned it inside out, found just some change and a dollar or two. I motioned to him to come into the hall. I wanted to discuss the situation. So we stepped outside and I said, Dunce interrupts him to ask if Mr. and Mrs. Clutter could overhear the conversation. No. We were just outside the door, where we could keep an eye on them. But we were whispering. I told Dick, "These people are telling the truth. The one who lied is your friend Floyd Wells. There isn't any safe, so let's get the hell out of here." But Dick was too ashamed to face it. He said he wouldn't believe it till we searched the whole house. He said the thing to do was tie them all up, then take our time looking around. You couldn't argue with him. He was so excited. The glory of having everybody at his mercy. That's what excited him. Well, there was a bathroom next door to Mrs. Clutter's room. The idea was to lock the parents in the bathroom and wake the kids and put them there, then bring them out one by one and tie them up in different parts of the house. And then, says Dick, after we've found the safe, we'll cut their throats. Can't shoot them, he says. That would make too much noise. Perry frowns, rubs his knees with his manacled hands. Let me think a minute. Because along in here things begin to get a little complicated. I remember. Yes. Yes, I took a chair out of the hall and stuck it in the bathroom, so Mrs. Clutter could sit down, seeing she was said to be an invalid. When we locked them up, Mrs. Clutter was crying and telling us, "Please don't hurt anybody. Please don't hurt my children." And her husband had his arms around her, saying, like, "Sweetheart, these fellows don't mean to hurt anybody. All they want is some money." We went to the boy's room. He was awake, lying there like he was too scared to move. Dick told him to get up, but he didn't move, or move fast enough, so Dick punched him, pulled him out of bed, and I said, "You don't have to hit him, Dick." And I told the boy, he was only wearing a t-shirt, to put on his pants. He put on a pair of blue jeans, and we'd just locked him in the bathroom when the girl appeared. Came out of her room. She was all dressed, like she'd been awake some while. I mean, she had on socks and slippers, and a kimono, and her hair was wrapped in a bandana. She was trying to smile. She said, "Good grief, what is this? Some kind of joke?" I don't guess she thought it was much of a joke, though. Not after Dick opened the bathroom door and shoved her in. Dewey envisions them. The captive family, meek and frightened, but without any premonition of their destiny. Herb couldn't have suspected, or he would have fought. He was a gentleman, but strong and no coward. Herb, his friend Alvin Dewey, felt certain would have fought to the death defending Bonnie's life and the lives of his children. Dick stood guard outside the bathroom door while I reconnoitered. I frisked the girl's room, and I found a little purse, like a doll's purse. Inside it was a silver dollar. I dropped it somehow, and it rolled across the floor, rolled under a chair. I had to get down on my knees. And just then it was like I was outside myself, watching myself in some nutty movie. It made me sick. I was just disgusted. Dick, and all his talk about a rich man's safe, and here I am crawling on my belly to steal a child's silver dollar. $1. And I'm crawling on my belly to get it. Perry squeezes his knees, asks the detectives for aspirin, thanks Dunce for giving him one, chews it, and resumes talking. But that's what you do. You get what you can. I frisked the boys' room, too. Not a dime. But there was a little portable radio, and I decided to take it. And then I remembered the binoculars I'd seen in Mr. Clutter's office. I went downstairs to get them. I carried the binoculars and the radio out to the car. It was cold, and the wind and the cold felt good. The moon was so bright you could see for miles. And I thought, why don't I walk off? Walk to the highway. Hitch a ride. I sure Jesus didn't want to go back in that house. And yet, how can I explain this? It was like I wasn't part of it. More as though I was reading a story. And I had to know what was going to happen. The end. So I went back upstairs. And now let's see. That's when we tied them up. Mr. Clutter first. We called him out of the bathroom, and I tied his hands together. Then I marched him all the way down to the basement. Dewey says, "Alone and unarmed?" I had the knife. Dewey says, "But Hickok stayed guard upstairs?" To keep them quiet. Anyway, I didn't need help. I've worked with rope all my life. Dewey says, "Were you using the flashlight or did you turn on the basement lights?" The lights. The basement was divided into two sections. One part seemed to be a playroom. Took him to the other section, the furnace room. I saw a big cardboard box leaning against the wall. A mattress box. Well, I didn't feel I ought to ask him to stretch out on the cold floor, so I dragged the mattress box over, flattened it, and told him to lie down. The driver, via the rearview mirror, glances at his colleague, attracts his eye, and Dunce slightly nods, as if in tribute. All along, Dewey had argued that the mattress box had been placed on the floor for the comfort of Mr. Clutter, and taking heed of similar hints, other fragmentary indications of ironic, erratic compassion, the detective had conjectured that at least one of the killers was not altogether uncharitable. I tied his feet, then tied his hands to his feet. I asked him, was it too tight, and he said no, but said would we please leave his wife alone. There was no need to tie her up. She wasn't going to holler or try to run out of the house. He said she'd been sick for years and years, and she was just beginning to get a little better, but an incident like this might cause her to have a setback. I know it's nothing to laugh over. Only I couldn't help it. Him talking about a setback. Next thing, I brought the boy down. First, I put him in the room with his dad. Tied his hands to an overhead steam pipe. Then I figured that wasn't very safe. He might somehow get loose and undo the old man, or vice versa. So I cut him down and took him to the playroom, where there was a comfortable-looking couch. I roped his feet to the foot of the couch, roped his hands, then carried the rope up and made a loop around his neck, so if he struggled, he'd choke himself. Once, while I was working, I put the knife down on this... Well, it was a freshly varnished cedar chest. The whole cellar smelled of varnish, and he asked me not to put my knife there. The chest was a wedding present he'd built for somebody. A sister, I believe he said. Just as I was leaving, he had a coughing fit, so I stuffed a pillow under his head. Then I turned off the lights.
Dewey says, but you hadn't taped their mouths?
No. The taping came later, after I'd tied both the women in their bedrooms. Mrs. Clutter was still crying. At the same time, she was asking me about Dick. She didn't trust him, but said she felt I was a decent young man. I'm sure you are, she says, and made me promise I wouldn't let Dick hurt anybody. I think what she really had in mind was her daughter. I was worried about that myself. I suspected Dick was plotting something. Something I wouldn't stand for. When I finished tying Mrs. Clutter, sure enough, I found he'd taken the girl to her bedroom. She was in the bed and he was sitting on the edge of it, talking to her. I stopped that. I told him to go look for the safe while I tied her up. After he'd gone, I roped her feet together and tied her hands behind her back. Then I pulled up the covers, tucked her in till just her head showed. There was a little easy chair near the bed, and I thought I'd rest a minute. My legs were on fire. All that climbing and kneeling. I asked Nancy if she had a boyfriend. She said yes, she did. She was trying hard to act casual and friendly. I really liked her. She was really nice. A very pretty girl, and not spoiled or anything. She told me quite a lot about herself. About school, and how she was going to go to a university to study music and art. Horses. Said next to dancing, what she liked best was to gallop a horse, so I mentioned my mother had been a champion rodeo rider. And we talked about Dick. I was curious, see, what he'd been saying to her. Seems she'd asked him why he did things like this. Rob people. And wow, did he toss her a tearjerker. Said he'd been raised an orphan in an orphanage, and how nobody had ever loved him, and his only relative was a sister who lived with men without marrying them. All the time we were talking, we could hear the lunatic roaming around below, looking for the safe. Looking behind pictures. Tapping the walls. Tap, tap, tap. Like some nutty woodpecker. When he came back, just to be a real bastard, I asked had he found it. Of course he hadn't, but he said he'd come across another purse in the kitchen. With $7. Dunce says, how long now had you been in the house?
Maybe an hour.
Dunce says, and when did you do the taping?
Right then.
Started with Mrs. Clutter. I made Dick help me, because I didn't want to leave him alone with the girl. I cut the tape in long strips, and Dick wrapped them around Mrs. Clutter's head like he'd wrap a mummy. He asked her, how come you keep on crying? Nobody's hurting you. And he turned off the bedside lamp and said, good night, Mrs. Clutter. Go to sleep. Then he says to me, as we're heading along the hall toward Nancy's room, I'm gonna bust that little girl. And I said, uh-huh. But you'll have to kill me first. He looked like he didn't believe he'd heard right. He says, what do you care? Hell, you can bust her too. Now that's something I despise. Anybody that can't control themselves sexually. Christ, I hate that kind of stuff. I told him straight, leave her alone. Else you've got a buzzsaw to fight. That really burned him. But he realized it wasn't the time to have a flat-out free-for-all. So he says, okay, honey, if that's the way you feel. The end of it was we never even taped her. We switched off the hall light and went down to the basement. Harry hesitates. He has a question but phrases it as a statement. I'll bet he never said anything about wanting to rape the girl. Dewey admits it, but he adds that except for an apparently somewhat expurgated version of his own conduct, Hickok's story supports Smith's. The details vary, the dialogue is not identical, but in substance the two accounts, thus far at least, corroborate one another. Maybe. But I knew he hadn't told about the girl. I'd have bet my shirt. Dunt says, Perry, I've been keeping track of the lights. The way I calculate it, when you turned off the upstairs light, that left the house completely dark.
Did. And we never used the lights again. Except the flashlight. Dick carried the flashlight when we went to tape Mr. Clutter and the boy. Just before I taped him, Mr. Clutter asked me, and these were his last words. Wanted to know how his wife was, if she was all right. And I said she was fine. She was ready to go to sleep. And I told him it wasn't long till morning, and how in the morning somebody would find them. And then all of it, me and Dick and all, would seem like something they dreamed. I wasn't kidding him. I didn't want to harm the man. I thought he was a very nice gentleman. Soft-spoken. I thought so right up to the moment I cut his throat. Wait. I'm not telling it the way it was. Perry scowls. He rubs his legs. The handcuffs rattle. After we'd taped them, Dick and I went off in a corner. To talk it over. Remember now. There were hard feelings between us. Just then it made my stomach turn to think I'd ever admired him, lapped up all that brag. I said, well, Dick, any qualms? He didn't answer me. I said, leave them alive, and this won't be any small rap. 10 years, the very least. He still didn't say anything. He was holding the knife. I asked him for it, and he gave it to me. And I said, all right, Dick. Here goes. But I didn't mean it. I meant to call his bluff. Make him argue me out of it. Make him admit he was a phony and a coward. See, it was something between me and Dick. I knelt down beside Mr. Clutter. And the pain of kneeling. I thought of that goddamn dollar. Silver dollar. The shame. Disgust. And they'd told me never to come back to Kansas. But I didn't realize what I'd done till I heard the sound. Like somebody drowning. Screaming underwater. I handed the knife to Dick. I said, finish him. You'll feel better. Dick tried. Or pretended to. But the man had the strength of 10 men. He was half out of his ropes. His hands were free. Dick panicked. Dick wanted to get the hell out of there. But I wouldn't let him go. The man would have died anyway, I know that. But I couldn't leave him like he was. I told Dick to hold the flashlight. Focus it. Then I aimed the gun. The room just exploded. Went blue. Just blazed up. Jesus. I'll never understand why they didn't hear the noise 20 miles around. Dewey's ears ring with it. A ringing that almost deafens him to the whispery rush of Smith's soft voice.
But the voice plunges on, ejecting a fusillade of sounds and images. Hickok hunting the discharged shell. Hurrying, hurrying, in Kenyon's head in a circle of light. The murmur of muffled pleadings, then Hickok again scrambling after a used cartridge. Nancy's room. Nancy listening to boots on hardwood stairs, the creak of the steps as they climb toward her. Nancy's eyes. Nancy watching the flashlight's shine seek the target. She said, "Oh, no. Oh, please. No. 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 Don't. Oh, please, don't. Please." I gave the gun to Dick. I told him I'd done all I could do. He took aim, and she turned her face to the wall. The dark hall. The assassins hastening toward the final door. Perhaps, having heard all she had, Bonnie welcomed their swift approach. That last shell was a bitch to locate. Dick wiggled under the bed to get it. Then we closed Mrs. Clutter's door and went downstairs to the office. We waited there, like we had when we first came. Looked through the blinds to see if the hired man was poking around, or anybody else who might have heard the gunfire. But it was just the same. Not a sound. Just the wind. And Dick, panting like wolves were after him. Right there, in those few seconds before we ran out to the car and drove away. That's when I decided I'd better shoot Dick. He'd said over and over. He'd drummed it into me. No witnesses. And I thought, he's a witness. I don't know what stopped me. God knows I should have done it. Shot him dead. Got in the car and kept on going till I lost myself in Mexico. A hush. For 10 miles and more, the three men ride without speaking. Sorrow and profound fatigue are at the heart of Dewey's silence. It had been his ambition to learn exactly what happened in that house that night. Twice now he'd been told, and the two versions were very much alike, the only serious discrepancy being that Hickok attributed all four deaths to Smith, while Smith contended that Hickok had killed the two women. But the confessions, though they answered questions of how and why, failed to satisfy his sense of meaningful design. The crime was a psychological accident, virtually an impersonal act. The victims might as well have been killed by lightning. Except for one thing. They had experienced prolonged terror. They had suffered. And Dewey could not forget their sufferings. Nonetheless, he found it possible to look at the man beside him without anger, with rather a measure of sympathy. For Perry Smith's life had been no bed of roses, but pitiful. An ugly and lonely progress toward one mirage and then another. Dewey's sympathy, however, was not deep enough to accommodate either forgiveness or mercy. He hoped to see Perry and his partner hanged. Hanged back to back. Dunce asks Smith, "Add it up. How much money did you get from the Clutters?" "Between $40 and $50. Among Garden City's animals are two gray tomcats who are always together. Thin, dirty strays with strange and clever habits. The chief ceremony of their day is performed at twilight. First, they trot the length of Main Street, stopping to scrutinize the engine grills of parked automobiles, particularly those stationed in front of the two hotels, the Windsor and Warren. For these cars, usually the property of travelers from afar, often yield what the bony, methodical creatures are hunting. Slaughtered birds. Crows, chickadees, and sparrows foolhardy enough to have flown into the path of oncoming motorists. Using their paws as though they are surgical instruments, the cats extract from the grills every feathery particle. Having cruised Main Street, they invariably turn the corner at Main and Grant, then lope along toward Courthouse Square, another of their hunting grounds. And a highly promising one on the afternoon of Wednesday, January 6th, for the area swarmed with Finney County vehicles that had brought to town part of the crowd populating the square. The crowd started forming at 4 o'clock, the hour that the county attorney had given as the probable arrival time of Hickok and Smith. Since the announcement of Hickok's confession on Sunday evening, newsmen of every style had assembled in Garden City. Representatives of the major wire services, photographers, newsreel and television cameramen, reporters from Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas, and of course, all the principal Kansas papers. 20 or 25 men altogether. Many of them had been waiting 3 days without much to do except interview the service station attendant James Spohr, who, after seeing published photographs of the accused killers, had identified them as customers to whom he'd sold $3.06 worth of gas the night of the Holcomb tragedy. It was the return of Hickok and Smith that these professional spectators were on hand to record, and Captain Gerald Murray of the Highway Patrol had reserved for them ample space on the sidewalk fronting the courthouse steps. The steps the prisoners must mount on their way to the county jail, an institution that occupies the top floor of the 4-story limestone structure. One reporter, Richard Parr of the Kansas City Star, had obtained a copy of Monday's Las Vegas Sun. The paper's headline raised rounds of laughter. Fear lynch mob awaiting return of killer suspects. Captain Murray remarked, "Don't look much like a necktie party to me." Indeed, the congregation in the square might have been expecting a parade or attending a political rally. High school students, among them former classmates of Nancy and Kenyon Clutter, chanted cheerleader rhymes, bubbled bubblegum, gobbled hot dogs and soda pop. Mothers soothed wailing babies. Men strode about with young children perched on their shoulders. The Boy Scouts were present, an entire troop, and the middle-aged membership of a women's bridge club arrived en masse. Mr. J.P. Jap Adams, head of the local Veterans Commission office, appeared, attired in a tweed garment so oddly tailored that a friend yelled, "Hey, Jap, what you doing wearing ladies' clothes?" For Mr. Adams, in his haste to reach the scene, had unwittingly donned his secretary's coat. A roving radio reporter interviewed sundry other townsfolk, asking them what, in their opinion, the proper retribution would be for the doers of such a dastardly deed. And while most of his subjects said gosh or gee whiz, one student replied, "I think they ought to be locked in the same cell for the rest of their lives. Never allowed any visitors. Just sit there staring at each other till the day they die." And a tough, strutty little man said, "I believe in capital punishment. It's like the Bible says, an eye for an eye. And even so, we're 2 pair short." As long as the sun lasted, the day had been dry and warm. October weather in January. But when the sun descended, when the shadows of the square's giant shade trees met and combined, the coldness as well as darkness numbed the crowd. Numbed and pruned it. By 6 o'clock, fewer than 300 persons remained. Newsmen, cursing the undue delay, stamped their feet and slapped frozen ears with ungloved, freezing hands. Suddenly, a murmuring arose on the south side of the square. The cars were coming. Although none of the journalists anticipated violence, several had predicted shouted abuse. But when the crowd caught sight of the murderers, with their escort of blue-coated highway patrolmen, it fell silent, as though amazed to find them humanly shaped. The handcuffed men, white-faced and blinking blindly, glistened in the glare of flash bulbs and floodlights. The cameramen, pursuing the prisoners and the police into the courthouse and up 3 flights of stairs, photographed the door of the county jail slamming shut. No one lingered, neither the press corps nor any of the townspeople. Warm rooms and warm suppers beckoned them, and as they hurried away, leaving the cold square to the 2 gray cats, the miraculous autumn departed too. The year's first snow began to fall. Part 4. The Corner. Institutional dourness and cheerful domesticity coexist on the 4th floor of the Finney County Courthouse. The presence of the county jail supplies the first quality, while the so-called sheriff's residence, a pleasant apartment separated from the jail proper by steel